Is for PSLGs? What's PSLG? Planar straight line graphs, right? So last time, yeah, data structures for PSLGs. Breaking the rules here, starting with before I finish my coffee. What were the main operations? We call them incidence operations. Now let me draw one first. Let's draw some planar straight line graph. Here's a planar straight line graph. And here's a vertex, here's a face. Incidence operations gave us information starting from a vertex edge or face. We could ask about the other vertices, edges, or faces that were incident to it. And usually we just change dimension by one, so a vertex could only ask about edges, an edge could ask down a dimension, it could ask about the two endpoints, or it could ask up a dimension and ask about the two faces on the other side. The interesting ones, the ones we actually wrote out the pseudocode for, were the ones which asked about the edges incident to a face, edges incident to a vertex, and the edges incident to a face. And those two operations, assuming the face didn't have any holes, those operations were almost symmetric. At least in the implementation we had for a particular data structure, which we called a half-edge data structure. So, I'll write like this, edges incident to F, edges incident to B. And so there was some symmetry between these two operations, and we're going to explore that symmetry in depth today. So remember, in both cases, the way the operation worked is that you started with some half edge associated with either the face or the vertex. Let's say I start with this half edge coming out of this vertex, and I did walk around. I think I took what? Previous, and then I took the twin of that. So I end up in this one for this one, and then I repeat with the previous and the twin, and I walk around in that way. So by repeatedly taking previous and twin, I get to the next, a half edge on the next one, and then I loop until I get back to where I started. Okay, it was almost the same for the face, right? For the face, I start with an arbitrary half edge. And I guess I just took next in that case. But again, I just take the next until I got all the way around to where I started again, and that's my whole list. Okay, so that gets me starting from one of these half edges. It tells me how to get to the next one, the next one, the next one in a nice cycle, and I get back to where I started, and that returns all of the incident edges. Well, part of this symmetry is a little bit more clear when the graph was, one connected? Because that implied that the faces have no holes. And two connected? If the underlying graph here is two connected, remember that graph connectivity, this vertex connectivity, is just a combinatorial property. It's just a property of the graph, independent of the drawing. We saw two connected planar graphs. We saw that the faces are polygons. Let's prove this with the Jordan curve theorem. Going along with this implied that every edge separated two different faces. Because if you have the same face on both sides, you can connect them up and in a big Jordan curve, closed Jordan curve, and removing just one endpoint of that edge would disconnect the graph because it would separate inside the simple closed curve from the outside. All right, so two connectivity was useful. We also mentioned three connectivity, which maybe we'll make a comeback today. So if the graph is three connected, we said that the faces are unique, or at least uniquely determined. So the same set of edges will form a face, no matter what drawing, and for a given three connected planar graph, the faces will be the same set of edges. So you get the same number of types of faces. Okay, well, certainly you'll get the same number of faces. You know why any two drawings of the same graph have the same number of faces? Do you believe it? If I give you the same graph, and I draw it one way and I draw it another way, I claim that the number of faces is the same. So let's start there. Why is it? You know what?
Just like what you said, stretching out the edges.
Just stretching
them somehow? They don't overlap or anything, so you just...
No?
No.
It was...
Is it because of Euler's theorem?
Yeah, Euler's formula.
They're associated to each other?
It's exactly from Euler's formula. Because Euler's formula says what? In the plane, for planar graphs, the number of vertices minus the number of edges plus the number of faces is equal to 2. So if we take a particular graph, it has some fixed set of vertices and some fixed set of edges. So these are constants. Everything is a constant. And then we can just do, middle school algebra to find out what the number of faces is. The number of faces is also a constant. So we should at least be clear on that. So the number of faces is the same, but if the graph is three connected, it turns out the identity of that those faces is the same, as the same set of edges will bound the faces. It won't guarantee which one is the outer face, as you can see from a very simple example like this one. I think this is the one I drew. I said if you have A, B, C, D, this is one drawing. Here's the same graph. Drawn differently, you can see the outer face is different. But this outer face, A, B, C, does appear as a face in this other drawing of the same graph. We'll explore a little bit more today in what sense there's an even stronger sense in which these drawings are symmetric. All right, so that was what we covered last time. Now let's put it to work. I'm going to tell you about a specific kind of PSLG, which is going to show up in the lecture towards the end. But it's useful to see, and we talked about it a little bit in terms of polygons. So we're going to talk about triangulations. We said that before we looked at triangulations of polygons. That was a decomposition of a polygon into triangles. Here, we're going to consider a triangulation. In fact, define a triangulation is a PSLG in which every face is a triangle. Okay, so let's start with something simple. Something like this. Triangulation. If you have n vertices, so if the vertex set here, the size of the vertex set is n, and that would be the usual case, we'll sometimes call this a triangulation of this vertex set, or we'll call it sometimes just refer to these vertices, because this is the embedding, this drawing of the vertices, so they become points. So we'll also call this a triangulation of the point set. So sometimes, can you see that up here? Sometimes we'll say a triangulation of a point set. So if we have n vertices, and every face is a triangle, we can apply Euler's formula to find out how many triangles there are. This is pretty relatively easy. We know that what V, size of V minus the number of edges plus the number of faces is 2. And we know every face has 3 edges, but every edge touches 2 faces. So we'd like, at first, we could say that like say F is equal to 3 times the number of edges because there's three edges per face, but that counts every one of them twice, so we divide by two. So f is equal to 3/2 the number of edges. We know this length of v is n, so when we plug it into Euler's formula, n minus e plus f equals 2, this f becomes 3/2 e. That's not right. Is that right? Should be every face has three edges. The 2/3 should be 2/3. Does that look right?
What is it?
Every edge is in, there's two faces per edge and three, I'm sorry, there's two edges, there's three edges per face.
What's the number of edges?
Two faces.
What's the number of faces? Three times per edge. F?
Each face?
Yes. And
after two, three edges.
Because really I just wanted to write this.
Yeah. It's the opposite one, right? Two face, three edges.
That's correct.
This looks right to me.
Yeah, because you have three edges to generate a face.
I think this is correct. So if you were to count all the edges twice.
Yeah.
The writing thing is just that.
Yeah.
And
then you count three times the number of faces. Good. We can also just check over here. I got six edges. 2 times 6 is 12. I got four triangles. 1, 2, 3, and the outer one. 4 times 3 is 12. So at least it works on the base case, and you can do induction from there if you like. Let's plug it in. What do you get? Let's get rid of e here. So let's write e equals 3/2 f. So this is n minus f over 2 equals 2. Got 2 tests. Got that? And that means what? That f is equal to 2n minus 4. So number of triangles and triangles. Easy. Okay? This kind of thing I would put in a little exercise that you guys learned up. We won't always require the outer face to be a triangle. So, in that case, we can do the same kind of analysis. This, if I have h points on the hull, on the convex hull, and k interior points I'll end up with that's 2k plus h minus 2 triangles. It's going to look like it's off by one, but you have to remember to count the outer face as well. So in the case where the h is equal to 3, what do we get? We get 2 n minus 3 plus 3 minus 2, 2n, is that right? Should it be plus 2? That's right. Okay, so we end up with 2n minus 5 triangles plus the outer face. In that case, is also a triangle because it's 2n minus 4. Okay, some basic combinatorics. It turns out that triangulations are maximal with respect to edges. And you can see that because, well, if I have a full triangulation and I added some other edge, it has to cut through a triangle. And since the triangles are faces, they're Jordan curves, it would have to cut, the only place for a new edge to end would be at one of the other vertices of that triangle, and there's already an edge there. And we're only dealing with simple graphs, so I can't add any new edges. So triangulation is actually our edge maximal. Can't add any more edges to triangulation. So these are actually giving us extramal results about combinatorics of planar graphs. No planar graph can have more than this many faces. And you can you could also plug this equation back in and get what? That E is equal to 3n minus 6. And the way you will use this most often is to say that if you have a planar graph, it's on n vertices, that these are both the number of edges and the number of faces are both big O of n. Sometimes it'll be useful for us to actually pull up these specific constants, 3 and 2, but the point is that the whole structure is linear. Even though a graph, an arbitrary graph could have what, n squared edges, planar graphs only have a linear number of edges. One little fact relating to what we have over here, I won't prove it, but I think you can, you should be able to at least sketch a proof of this on your own, is that triangulations are three connected. And the way you would prove something like this is to say, well, if you take any graph that's only two connected, that means you can remove two vertices and break it into two disconnected components. If it's only two connected, then one of the faces is not a triangle. So you'd be proving the contrapositive. And with regards to this, remember this was called Whitney's theorem, so it doesn't mean that the triangles are immediately determined. All right. So keep triangulations in mind as we go forward, because we're going to leave them for a second and then rediscover them in a somewhat odd place.
What about just a single triangle? It's two connected.
It's the only example. We'll just leave it at that. So that's why when we defined K connectivity, we did have this weird condition that it has to have more than K vertices. It's the only bad case. All right, so we talked about data structures. Here's some triangulations. I'm going to glue this together in a roundabout way. The main operations were incidence operations. And so if you list all the information we had stored, we had vertices, we had edges, we had faces, incidence gives what's called a partial order. So it defines a partially ordered set is often just referred to as a poset. And here's the order relation. We're going to say that this incident to E, this is a vertex and an edge, if and only if V is actually an element of E. So this is assuming we're actually looking at the drawing of the graph. So after we've drawn it, the edge is a straight line segment. And the vertices that are actually on that line segment are the incident vertices. This is a bit of a jump because I took what was a combinatorial relationship, being the endpoint of an edge, and turned it into a geometric one, being an element of a subset. Question?
Yeah, what's that weird symbol point between P and E mean?
Oh, this is my partial order symbol. It's like a curly less than symbol.
Okay.
Just to distinguish it, because we're not really putting a total order on the cells here. Okay. I'm going to call these the cells. Zero-dimensional cells, one-dimensional cells, two-dimensional cells. And this will give us our first hint that we can do something in even higher dimensions. Okay, so that's vertices and edges. Similarly, we can do this for edges and faces, an edge incident to a face. And in fact, it doesn't really matter the dimension here. If I have, since it's a partial order, it has to be transitive, so if I have a vertex that's in an edge that's in a face, we'll say that the vertex is in the face. I'll let me finish writing this. Okay, and I'm treating these here as subsets of RD, or R2, of the plane.
Excuse me, sorry. Yeah. I didn't get what a partial order mean exactly here.
Oh, yeah. So if you have a set that's ordered,
okay,
then you can ask for any two sets, what is one less than the other?
Oh, okay.
Or less than or greater than. A partially ordered set is that some of the pairs, you can ask that question. So in particular, this doesn't tell us anything about whether a particular vertex, two distinct vertices, if one is greater than or less than the other.
Yeah.
So the real numbers are totally ordered. A quintessential example for partially ordered sets comes from like scheduling. So if you like, what's a good scheduling example?
Round Rubin?
What's that?
Round Rubin scheduling?
Well, not that kind of, I'm thinking it would be like really simple things, like when you get up in the morning, you get dressed in the morning, you have to put your socks on before your shoes, but like you can put your pants and your socks on in any order, right? They're not ordered, they're not strictly ordered. So, right, only some of the elements are ordered. The other way you've seen this maybe in computer science is that this gives rise to a directed acyclic graph. Directed acyclic graphs, show hands. You know your directed acyclic graphs? No? Brand new. Okay, wow. All right, let's
this is tree.
What's that?
Let's just say tree.
Let's say tree? A tree is a directed tree?
Acyclic graph.
That's an acyclic graph, yes.
The parental is relatively directed.
That's true. That's a good start. Let's say you have a tree. Where the arrows, let's say the edges are all direct. It's a rooted tree, so there's some notion of forward. Okay, and I can talk about some nodes being ancestors of other nodes. You know, this one is an ancestor of this one, and that is a partial order. So an ordering has to be transitive, so A is less than B and B is less than C, then A is less than C. It has to be acyclic, right? It has to be consistent. Like if I had a situation where A was less than B was less than C, and C was less than A, it would go around in a loop and it would give us some weird contradictions. There would be no consistent ordering. Partial orders have to at least be sane in that they don't have these cycles. And so if I have if I add some more relations here, that is to say, if I allow myself to compare this one and this one, there still aren't any directed cycles. Even though as an undirected graph, I would see a cycle in this, I can't go from here just following arrows and get back to here. This is a directed acyclic graph. So if you look at the underlying undirected graph, it can have cycles, but as a directed graph, there are no cycles. And the acyclicity, the lack of cycles, is what guarantees that the partial order is consistent. Okay. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to take a planar straight line graph, and I'm going to represent the partially ordered set that we get from the vertices, edges, and faces in that planar straight line graph. So let's draw a particular example. Let's keep it simple. It's just a graph. It's got four vertices. It's got five edges. It's got three faces. Let's label them. this is phase one, phase two, phase three will be the one out here on the outside. I need four vertices, V1, V2, V3, V4. I need to label these edges. I'll call them E1, E2, E3, E4, and E5. So I'm going to write down the post set. What do I have? I've got three faces, five edges, four vertices. Here's how I'll do it. F1, F2, F3. E1, E2, E3, E4, E5, E1, E2, E3, and E4. And now I'm going to draw, say, some directed arrows to represent the partial order relations. So this face and these partial relations, these are the incidence operations. This is what I get when I run incidence operations on this. So F1 has what edges? E1, E2, and E3. 1, 2, 3. Just assume all the arrows are directed down. E1 has what? Which vertices on its endpoints? V1 and V2. E2 goes from 2 to 3. E3 goes 1 to 3. I should do this in a more systematic way, but I'll just go to the rest of the edges. E4 was 1 to 4. And E5 was 4 to 3. Good. F2 was E3, 4, 5. And F3 is... This is where it's going to get messy. 1, 2. Okay, so if all the arrows are directed down from level to level, the level below, this is going to, this gives me a representation of this partially ordered set. And all I've done is given you a different way of describing all the incidence operations. And why would you do that? Well, we claimed, at least, that for planar straight line graphs, when we store them in the computer, the kinds of operations we want to do are exactly these incidence operations. So this is not a data structure, but it sort of could be if you took your favorite directed graph data structure and stored all this information. This would have all the information in it. You could answer these queries from navigating this graph. But that's not the reason we're going to use it. Okay? We're going to use it to extract some other symmetries in the structure. In particular, we're going to see where this symmetry comes from. And we're going to get, I'm going to show you a different, something that's closer to a data structure that actually generalizes almost every planar graph data structure you'll ever see. So think about this while I finish my copy. All right. Any questions? Who's lost? It's all right. No one, all right. I got you. You're all with me here. You got this. It's not complicated stuff. Like, it's a lot of notation. It's new vocabulary. But the concepts, you know, concepts are intuitive. This idea of a partial order is everywhere. All right. So this is the post set. When I draw it like this, sometimes this is called a Haas diagram. I'll just give you that name because you may see it again in your life somewhere else. So this is the Haas diagram. And for these, the Haas diagrams of planar graphs, you could do something kind of cool, which is called dualizing a planar graph. Maybe some of you have seen this operation. Who's dualized a planar graph? Planar graph duals? Let's dualize this one. What I do is I take each face and I put a vertex for every face. So I'm going to take the graph that I have. In fact, I'm going to take the drawing of the graph that I have. It's important. It has to be a drawing because I can't even do this first step until I've drawn the graph. Because I don't have faces until I've drawn the graph. this is a little shaky because technically if it's three connected, maybe there exists some canonical faces, but let's pretend I drew the graph, and now I can say what a face is, and I can have a vertex for every face. It doesn't matter where I put it now, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw an edge connecting two of these new vertices if the corresponding faces were separated by an edge. So I got this one for E4, this one here, this one technically goes out to here. This new graph that I got, this new planar graph, also is a planar straight line. Well, it's at least a drawing of a graph. And I don't think you have to think too hard to see that this definition applies not just to planar straight line graphs, but to any drawing of a graph. What did we do? We created faces for every vertex, or an edge for every edge, and now, you can observe also that every one of the original vertices is in its own face if I look at the red graph. So there's a correspondence between the faces in the original graph and the vertices in the dual, and the edges in the original graph and the edges in the dual, and the vertices in the original graph and the faces in the dual. If I were to draw the Haas diagram for this red graph, it would look exactly like this, but turned upside down. So one way to arrive at the dual in a purely combinatorial way, because this is capturing the combinatorial structure, where combinatorial now means I'm talking about systems of sets and the inclusion of one set into another. So if I turn this upside down, that gives me at least the combinatorial structure of the dual graph. It doesn't tell me where to draw the points. You see, that's actually missing from this representation. It's sort of assumed that the vertices, say, store some geometric information. Like the vertices maybe store the coordinates of where I actually drew those vertices as points. And when I say planar straight line graph, that allows me to maybe also assume I know something about the geometry of the edges. But as a purely combinatorial object now, this is really what this kind of object is the foundation of what's called combinatorial topology. Just write that here, you don't have to learn combinatorial topology, but you're going to learn enough of the combinatorial topology of the plane to do some cool stuff. Right. So, what does this have to do with our instance operations? Well, this operation, which took us from a face to the edges incident to that face, is exactly dual to this other operation, which takes us from a vertex to the edges incident to that vertex. It's actually, these are the same operations. One is asking about the primal, the first, the original graph, we'll call the primal. The other one is the same operation on the dual. There's some weird things that can happen. So if you start playing with some examples, you may quickly say, wait a minute, hold on, stop. What do I do if my graph is something like this? You do have to decide if, for instance, I wanted to say, in order to actually have a face here, this guy has to wrap all the way around like that. And now the dual graph is not a simple graph. Right, it has this self loop. And that's not the only bad one. You can also have bad examples from something like this, where let's just look at the interior for now. I have multiple edges between here and here. I even have multiple edges between here and here. So it's not simplicity that is the lack of parallel edges or self-loops in a graph isn't necessarily preserved by duality. So you can start with a simple graph, you can dualize it, and it won't look so simple anymore. These problems do go away in one special wonderful case, which is right here, three connected graphs. We won't need to assume something this strong for now. For now, let's say that we allow some multiple edges, but we do at least require it to be two connected. And two connectivity, remember, implies that what faces are all polygons. And so we can at least, we'll just make that one assumption going forward. So I hinted that dualizing the incident structure gives us a dual graph, and that these operations are dual to each other. And there's going to be some very important planar straight line graphs that we're going to deal with where we care about that particular planar straight line graph, but we also care about its dual at the same time. And so what we'll get from this is we're going to come up with a different data structure for PSLGs that manages to store both the graph and its dual at the same time. And it turns out to be very natural to do that. In fact, you won't have to do any operation on the data structure in order to dualize. It takes that mathematical abstraction of duality and instantiates it directly in the data structure. It's just there in the data structure. So when we talk about a duality, that's a kind of symmetry. And you want that same symmetry to be present in the data structure, which we didn't really have. It wasn't so clean in the symmetry between these two operations, because remember, one of them we had to do just next, 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 next. The other one was, well, previous plus twin. It was this somehow, one of them required a double operation, one was only a single operation. And we'll see, hopefully, and work through it all, you'll see why that was the case. All right. So let me just throw out some famous dual graphs from history. So most of you know about the platonic solids. Well, platonic solids are three-dimensional polyhedra. How many platonic solids are there?
Five
platonic solids. Because the ancients knew this. There could only be five, because there were five planets. So it was known that, you know, each planet was corresponding to a different platonic solid, and they were all nested. Okay, maybe that wasn't good astronomy, but it was at least good geometry. So these are 3D, and I claimed we were talking about 2D things, but you know the surface of a convex polytope is a planar graph. If I just look at this, there's vertices here and there's edges. This is actually a planar graph, and I could draw it in the plane. Maybe I'll draw it right here for you. Okay, there's a natural way of doing this. This is called stereographic projection, which talk about another day. But I promise you that if you have a convex polytope, I can draw it in the plane. So this, the dual of this, like so, some kind of, let's see, what does it have here? It's actually a triangulation. Well, that's cool. Every face is a triangle here. Does anyone know anything about this graph? Any Dungeons and Dragons fans? Usually, I guess it's not a tetrahedron. It's got how many faces? Let's see, how many faces does it have? It's got one face for every vertex of the cube. The cube had how many vertices? 8. Good. So it would be some graph that has 8 triangles. What's a D8 look like? Do you know what D8 means? This is like I bet there was a time when you could walk into any computer science classroom and talk about Dungeons and Dragons. And that would be like, duh. And I think I got more blanks there. So a D8 is an 8-sided dice. You ever seen an 8-sided die, I should say, singular? It has a name. Octahedron. Heard of octahedron? Let me draw it. Okay, I'll draw it in red so it's clear that it's the dual. There it is. Octahedron. Okay, it's like a square pyramid. pyramid on top and on the bottom. Every face is an equilateral triangle. And that's the dual of a cube. So, in fact, all the planars, all the platonic solids have well-known duals. Yeah, what's the, I'm going to show off now. Let's see if I dare any of you to draw a dodecahedron. Let's see. This is, okay, I won't show the back side. 12 pentagons. Takes a lot of practice to do this. I think you're appreciating how difficult that was. All right. But it has a dual as well. 12, it's got 12 pentagonal faces. How many vertices does it have? Quick, how many vertices does it have? Okay. If you know your platonic solids, in fact, there's only a couple possibilities. There's only two left. There's only two platonic solids we haven't touched yet. One is the tetrahedron. It's not the tetrahedron. It only has four vertices. What's the other one? It's a d20. 20-sided dice. See the 20-sided dice? Something like that. Icosahedron. There's 20 vertices here, there's 20 faces here. And you can see every one of these three pentagons, at each vertex, there's three pentagons meeting to the triangular face. Okay, so this is dodecahedron to icosahedron. And the last one, the tetrahedron, I'll draw it in the plane for you. What's the dual to a tetrahedron? Shout it out, someone said it.
Itself.
Yeah. The dual to a tetrahedron is also a tetrahedron, which it makes sense that one of them would be self-dual, because I told you they all have duals, and there's only five. It's an odd number. Yeah. So, famous duals from history. In this case, the duality can also be realized in a more specifically geometric way, which we'll talk about. But here, for now, all we care about is what we call the combinatorial duality, duality between these face, edge, vertex, incidence relationships. Now, when I draw these, one of the things that's always really awkward is the outer face. So you always end up with this sort of like bubble here. And so as a convenience, one of the things I'm going to do is I'm going to, when I draw these, the outer face, I'm going to imagine that the point is at infinity. It's really far away. So in the future, when I draw the dual to, say, a cube graph, I will draw it like this. Out to infinity, where it's assumed that these actually go out and meet somewhere. So if I start with the plane and I add some point where these all meet, which I'm calling infinity, this is the plane, R2, union with a point called infinity. So topologically, this is a sphere. You know, if you have a sphere, and you pull one point off the top, you can kind of unwrap it out to the plane, the whole plane. Here I took the plane and I added that one point back in and reversed it. So that's why we have the plane here, and that's why we're talking about that infinite case. Okay. If you really knew your order of this formula, you'd know that I secretly wrote this 2 corresponds to the sphere and not really the plane. So that'll be a convention that we use, and now we'll be able to do but let me just make it clear why, another reason I want to do that. You see, the tetrahedron is a good example. I drew the tetrahedron like this, but I had a choice when I was drawing this. That looks like it matters. Like, it looks like it makes a difference if I draw this edge that goes around this way, or if I draw it so it goes around the other way. It seems like I really changed what the faces look like. In a sense, I have. I've at least changed which one is going to count as the infinite face. And before, the face that was the infinite face was the one dual to this vertex. And now, when I swoop it around this way, the infinite face is the one dual to this vertex. Okay, but on the sphere, the infinite face isn't special. It's not different from the others. So in fact, these are the same, and it's more clear that they're the same when I draw it like this, where I draw the infinite face, or the dual to the unbounded face at infinity. And I guess what that means over here is that in the Haas diagram, you don't really see the notion of the infinite face. Like this one, none of these is singled out as the outer face, and that makes sense because this structure is independent of, once you have the structure doesn't specify the drawing. And you can take the same structure and draw it different ways and choose different faces to be on that outer face. Any questions? Everybody doing all right? So now what we're going to look at is something called the barycentric decomposition. Which is a really nice idea, which you can see as coming out of the Poset structure, or I think more immediately you can see it when we draw it, just draw it on a PSLG. So let's start with a PSLG, something like this. The barycentric decomposition is an attempt to kind of capture all this information that's in the Haas diagram right here on the PSLG. So what I'll do is for every, well, the vertices are all here. For every edge, I'll put a new vertex right at its midpoint. Okay. And I'm also going to add a new vertex for every face, similar to the way I did with the dual. So here, and I've got one out there at infinity.
This would be, this vertices could be anywhere on the face?
Yes. So if the face is, there's a special kind of drawing which we might call a convex drawing where all the faces are nice convex polygons. And that hints at where this name comes from because you know what a barycenter is? Anyone heard of a barycenter? Barycenter is also the centroid. It's the center of mass. I don't know what the etymology of that is, but a barycenter is a centroid. It's a convex combination of the points. So if I take the barycenter of a set of points, is just the average of all their coordinates. So the center, I usually will call it the centroid. It's also the mean, but the centroid of say points u1 to un is just 1 over n times the sum of the ui's. So if you have a special case where all these cells are nice convex objects, you can draw the points at the centers. So one case where this really does happen, and I've left it up here, is the case of triangulations. Right? So in a triangulation, if it's a plane of straight line graph, it's a triangulation, then you can draw the vertex for the face right at the barycenter of the three vertices that form that face. For now, we'll just say it's anywhere because you can see it in the geometry, but we only care about the connectivity structure. So it could be anywhere in there. And rather than drawing the dual here, what we're going to do is we're going to draw all the incidence relationships as edges. So there's a one here. Technically, yeah. I'm not going to redraw all the black parts, but the black parts are also here, right? So there's this edge, this vertex here corresponds to an edge in the original graph, and it's incident to these two vertices, so it has these two edges. It's also incident to this face, and I guess technically I should be drawing these out to the infinite one. Okay. So this is actually a way to draw this graph in the plane. All right, so maybe this is gets us closer to what we want because it gives us yet another representation of all of the incident structure of the PS of a particular drawing of the PSLG. And now there's some observations to make about these triangles. So first of all, this is really a triangulation. So I called it a decomposition, but it is a triangulation, assuming when the graph is two connected. That was one of the reasons we made this assumption. So if the graph is two connected, this will give us a triangulation. And it makes sense that it's a triangulation because what are these triangles? This is a vertex of the original graph, this was an edge of the original graph, and this was a face of the original graph. So this came from something zero-dimensional, one-dimensional, and two-dimensional for this triangle here. Now, if you look, you'll find that every single triangle in this decomposition has this property where one of the vertices came from an original vertex, one of the vertices came from an original edge, and one of the vertices came from an original face. So that if you number the vertices by the dimension they started from, you'll find that every triangle is numbered 0, 1, and 2. Does that look right? Do you believe that? Well, where are these triangles in this graph? Well, they are paths that go from what? A 0, a 1, a two-dimensional face, and because of transitivity, it's a partial order, so by transitivity you get this whole triangle. If we don't draw this edge, we can think about the barycentric triangles, the triangles in this decomposition, as being paths from the top to the bottom in the Haas diagram. Okay. Now to get to a data structure. What was our old data structure? Our old data structure seemed to take, for every edge, for each side of the edge, you kept a handle. We called them half edges. Let me draw one. We had one over here. We had its twin over here. And you could think of this now as really being these two triangles. The half edge corresponded to the two triangles because there will be two triangles, two barycentric triangles on each side of each edge. Because there's a face on each side, and the edge, the endpoints of the edge, the new vertex created on that edge, and the face will create these two triangles. So, two triangles. And so our half edge data structure, you could think about it as being, we took the barycentric decomposition, we took the neighbor relationships between the triangles, and we grouped them in pairs. And the next operation said go from this pair to this pair. Or the twin operation said go from this pair to this pair. Or the previous said go from this pair to this pair. Well, if we wanted to now dualize this, all we would do is we would take these numbers, and we change the 2s to 0s, and the 0s to 2s, the 1s would stay 1s, that would give us, that would be the same as flipping this upside down, And the barycentric triangles, which were just paths from the top to the bottom, are still just going to be the same triangles. So the barycentric decomposition encodes both the primal and the dual. In fact, the primal and the dual have the same barycentric decomposition. We're saying here it's kind of isomorphism. It's a graph isomorphism. You can map one into the other, and they have the same set of edges. And so that's kind of cool, and we can define a new data structure on top of the barycentric decomposition, where instead of talking about half edges, we just hold on to the triangles. Okay? So you just take a triangle, and now, well, okay, we've lost some of our efficiency, because what we'll have now is for every edge, we'll actually have four handles into the data structure. But we gain something else, which is that now it's much clearer how to go from primal to the dual. First, let me tell you how you walk around in this data structure. When I talk about having a handle into the data structure, you just think of that just as a pointer. And these data structures, as we started with the intuition from just a linked list, you have a pointer into the data structure and some pointers to neighboring handles. And that's, you should think of this as really being local operations. Like, you're standing somewhere in the data structure, and you want to know, where can I get to from here with one step? And those one steps, really, in this case, you're going to have three possible steps, because you have a triangle, and you're just going to go to one of the three neighboring triangles. What is that? How do we differentiate between those three different operations? Well, if I'm right here, and I want to go this way, what I'm doing is I'm taking the, this could be a one. I'm taking the vertex labeled one, I'm throwing it out, and I'm adding a new vertex labeled one. So this would be the operation called operation one. If I go this way, I'm taking, I'm getting from this triangle to this triangle, the difference is the vertex labeled two. So this would be the two operation. And if I go this way, I throw out this vertex and I add in this one to get the new triangle, that's the zero operation. So I've got the operation 0, 1, and 2, which take me from one barycentric triangle to another. Alright, these three operations are almost, but not quite, the three operations we had before. So the half-edge data structure, you can think of it as an optimization over this, where they took adjacent pairs of these triangles and they glued them together, and they got some little bit more, they gave up some efficiency in one of the traversal operations, and they gained they only store half as many handles into the data structure. What they lose, of course, is that now it's a little bit more complex to talk about the dual. So you can write the dual operations using those previous next and twin operations, whereas here, the dual walking around in the dual of the graph is automatic. Okay. So the point of drawing it all this way is that all those symmetries that are present in the graph are now completely present in the data structure. That's pretty heavy. So, is there any questions here? Yeah?
So you won't play the very standard missing point for each phase?
Well, okay. So, in the data structure, for a particular graph, for a particular planar straight line graph, the dual is a combinatorial notion. Mm-hmm. It's not a geometric one. You can draw it, but the drawing is not determined by the original drawing. In the case of triangulations, I wrote this. This is where the name comes from, because in the case of triangulations, then there's always you can always really draw it as the barycentric, as drawing the vertices at the barycenters. And that's fine, but here there's no real drawing, so you don't have to put this at the barycenter. It's just the information that we're storing. It may be, and it will be the case for some of the things we look at, that you do have some geometric information, and you have some place that you are going to put this vertex. So when I draw a particular plane straight line graph, its dual may have some meaning, in which case I actually know where to draw the vertices. And that's what we'll do very soon, I think. Okay, the other nice thing about this whole presentation is that once you have this kind of structure, you don't have to think, you don't have to limit your thinking to the plane. Okay, so instead of drawing just vertices and edges, if I have some more structure, like if I have vertices, edges, two-dimensional faces, three-dimensional cells, and they have this partial order operation, I may still be able to draw, I can still draw this fast diagram, and I, under some conditions similar to our two connectivity condition, you can do the same kind of dualizing operation, and you can do the same barycentric decomposition trick. And so that's the other reason I wanted to show you this, even though for now mostly we're just going to care about the plane. I want you to at least know that the representation of these types of combinatorial topological objects and the incidence operations generalize to any number of dimensions. We will talk a little bit about some of these in particular, things like high-dimensional triangulations. And I'll give you just one example of a nice kind of geometric object that has this combinatorial topological structure and can be represented by barycentric decompositions. Okay, and actually we've already seen it today a little bit, and it's going to be polyhedra. So, polyhedron for the sake of this course, and this is not a definition that I'm making up, but since this is such a classic notion, this word's been defined many times, we're going to say that a polyhedron is the intersection of a finite set of closed half spaces. I'll write it down and we'll talk about it.
So it must be convex.
Yeah, so we're only going to deal with convex polyhedra.
Can polyhedra be non-convex?
Some people think so. I mean, it, like many classic terms, depending on which sub-area of mathematics you're in, the word will have different technical definitions. So this is the common technical definition in polytope theory and computational geometry. Okay, so it's the intersection of a finite set of half spaces. Half spaces. Everybody remember what half space is? In D dimensions, we'll say in the plane, a half space is everything on one side of the line. Actually, I forgot to say this, a closed half spaces means it includes the line too. So let me draw a closed half space, so everything on this. So in particular, a single half space is a polyhedron. If I take two half spaces, maybe I'll draw some more in here. Let me draw this one, and maybe one coming down like this. The intersection of all these is a polyhedron. In the plane, we talk about these as polygons. You'll notice that polyhedra don't necessarily have to be bounded, though. It could go off to infinity. So it's a little different from the kind of, from just the polygons. Maybe you could think of it as a polygon where there's some vertices out in at infinity, possibly. you'll sometimes see the word, I'll write this here for now, a polytope.
Is this a face of a polytope? That the outer side?
What's that?
So it is a polytope just the outer surface of the polyhedron?
No, a polytope is a bounded polyhedron. So in a special case where it's not doesn't go up to infinity, we call that a polytope. Alright, so so in our two polytopes, such as polygons, but they give us a way of talking about these things in higher dimensions. We've got some examples over here of polytopes. Actually, really, it's enough for us to talk about polyhedra right now. So these are also polyhedra. The cube is the intersection of what, six, is that right? Six half closed half spaces, one for each of the faces. Octahedron, there's eight closed half spaces, one for each of the faces. The dimension of a face, the dimension of a polytope, or a polyhedron, is just going to be the dimension of its affine closure. And this is a notion that confused a lot of people on the homework. Let's spell it out a little bit more. The dimension of a polyhedron is the dimension of its affine closure. That is to say, the set of all affine combinations of points in the polyhedron. So I could take a in R3, I could take two half spaces that are bounded by the same plane. Where I take one side, one of them is on one side, the other is on the other side. Their intersection is just the plane. Do you believe me? Can you see this? Maybe I'll do it in 2D first. In 2D, I take a line, and I take one half space, which is on one side of the line, and the other half space on the other side of the line. Okay? There's two half spaces. Their intersection is just the line. Does that mean the class is over? What time is it? So I thought it was like a... You know, you could have like, it used to be the gong show where they like hit a gong and they're like, you're done, get off the stage. So I can have a one-dimensional polyhedron even though I'm in 2D. And in fact, I can have a polyhedron of any dimension. The dimension, you should think of dimension, affine dimension is really our intuitive notion of dimension. It's like, if it's a line, it's just one-dimensional object, and if it's a plane, no matter where that plane is, it's a two-dimensional object. That was what you were supposed to kind of get a better sense of by doing the homework. And I guess I'm going to have time. Okay, I've got 4 minutes. I'm going to push on. Okay, so there's if you look at a particular polyhedron, you look at the affine closure, there's all the affine combinations. So if I have this line, the affine combinations of that line is just the whole line, is the polyhedron itself. If I had a third half space, say, going this way, the polyhedron in black would be just, you know, from this half line, would start from here and go off to infinity. Its dimension is still one. That's the point of its definition. Here's a little fact. The boundary of a polyhedron, so the things that are actually touching those half spaces, that's actually touching the hyperplanes that bound the half spaces. So half space is everything bounded by a hyperplane. Hyperplane is what? Set of solutions to a single linear equation. The boundary is the union of polyhedra one dimension lower. In this case, it's a one-dimensional polyhedron. Its boundary has just this one point on it. This is the only boundary point here. It's a zero-dimensional object. So the point here is that since you're going down one dimension when you go from the polyhedron to its boundary, you get a collection of other polyhedra. A polyhedron is also OSET. Questions? We have 1 minute. So send me your homework before class on Wednesday.